Maria Zakharian gave me some interesting things from various websites online, and there's interesting one here by Alan Knight. Now, how many have the book Primitive Christianity in Crises? Okay. If you don't have one, just call the office and ask for one, because we have some there. And Alan Knight has put out another book called The Spirit of Antichrist. And he gave me a pre-copy of it. And it's actually a pretty good book. The title is really the best part of it, The Spirit of Antichrist. However, in his presentation of it, he goes around and around and around and around and around in circles trying to come to where he's going to make his point, and it's still kind of hard to understand it. And he wrote me and told me that he's gone to press with it and they revised it considerably, and I was happy to hear that they revised it considerably. He had some, how shall I say, some odd interpretations of Revelation 17 and 13, because he takes that from the current history of the Roman Empire, which many of the Protestant commentators do today. But other than that, he has a pretty good Spirit of Antichrist. Now, we're going to take questions concerning the Passover today. Before I get there, Habib gave me this magazine by John Hagee. Anyway, I have in my hand what someone gave me that I don't recall who did. John Hagee. I recall Bob Ellsworth gave it to me. Very interesting. And I saw just a clip of his stance concerning Israel, and he just wrote a book, just published it, in defense of Israel. And it's typical of evangelical Protestantism that supports the Jews in Palestine. And that's the proper way to express it. It is not the Holy Land, because it's anything but holy today. And it's not Israel, because Israel is not there today. And he stood up and said, all the boundaries, he said, the Palestinians don't own the land. Said God gave it to them by covenant, and all the boundaries are listed in the Bible, and it's for the Jews. Says nothing about the other 11 tribes. Now, if you want to give to Judah what they had around Palestine, that's a different story. See, let's come to the book of Zephaniah here. Let's look at something to help us understand the enigma of what's going on in Jerusalem. Okay, book of Zephaniah. You have, okay, there we go, Zephaniah. Okay, Zephaniah chapter 2. When you look at the problems that they are having in Palestine today between the Jews and the Palestinians, and it's not between Israelites and the Palestinians, because there were 12 tribes of Israel, of which the Jews is only one. And here, John Hagee stands up and says it all belongs to the Jews, and there's another great error that comes with it. They say that everything in the Old Testament was Judaism, and Judaism was nothing what the Old Testament is, but just the skeletal framework of the Old Testament and all the traditions and oral traditions that the Jews have replaced the scriptures with. And this is the difficulty. Most people don't understand that. John Hagee doesn't understand that. So it's not Israel in the Holy Land, it's the Jews in Palestine. Now here in Zephaniah, the second chapter, and let's pick it up here in verse 5. And this has been true all the time since the expulsion of the Jews and destruction of the temple in 70 AD. All right, verse 5. And the sea coast shall be for dwellings and cottages, for shepherds and folds of flocks. And the coast, Zephaniah 2, verse 6. Yeah, drop down one verse. If I said verse 5, sorry about that. Now verse 7. The coast shall be for the remnant of the house of Judah. And the house of Judah means the Jews, part of Benjamin, and a majority of what were the Levites and later the priests. That's the house of Judah. The house of Israel, you have to go back to the days of Jeroboam and Rehoboam, and you see where the kingdom split. And then in order to find out where modern-day Israel is today, you have to have the book Judah Scepter, Joseph Birthright, which, by the way, is out of copyright, and it might serve as well somewhere down the road to go ahead and use that and add more material and bring it up to date. So the coast shall be for the remnant of the house of Judah. Now, that's near Tel Aviv. Now, Tel Aviv, where there's the greatest number of Jews, are right along the seacoast there. And near Tel Aviv is where Jebna was. Well, after the temple was destroyed, the Levites, and I don't think any priests escaped, or very few, unless they went ahead of time, They went up to Tiberias, and they went over to Jebna, and then Jebna was a center for the Jews and the Levites. There's where they wrote the Talmud. There's where they wrote the Mishnah. And that's where they preserved as much knowledge as they could about the temple after it had been destroyed. So it's interesting that's where the Jews have the most freedom from terrorism. Once in a while, they have a suicide bomber go up there. But in Jerusalem and around the area, which God did not say that they would have all the West Bank, you see, the Jews took it upon themselves to take all the West Bank, which was not theirs to take. Just like with the area where the Mosque of Omar is, they say that's a temple area, and that's not the temple area. And if you really want to put the world in a destructive mode, try building the temple there by scraping the top of that off to put the temple on it. Never happened. So that's why they have so much trouble there. Every time they say, we're going to have peace talks, what happened? War breaks out. So it's going to be a difficult process to bring that to a time of peace. And with the election coming up and everything that we have facing us today, it's going to be a tough row to hoe. So Hagee says that the Jews have the right to all the land from the Nile to the border of Syria, over to the Euphrates River, down south of that, and coming straight across back over to where Eilat is, and then that's supposed to be all for the Jews. Well, not quite so fast. That was the original area defined for all the 12 tribes. So what they are trying to do is take credit for being all the 12 tribes of Israel. And that can never work. But he's a staunch defender of the Jews in Palestine. And I think that his stance is also exacerbating the situation over there as well. Okay. Now, what I want to cover today is the difference between Exodus 12 and Deuteronomy 16. Exodus 12 and Deuteronomy 16. Okay. Let's look at that, because in Exodus 12 we have it defined quite clearly. So let's go there. Okay. Exodus 12. Now God told them to take a lamb for every house, and if the house was too small, to share it with his neighbor next door. And let's pick it up here in verse 5. Exodus 12 and verse 5. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male. Now we're going to see types of Christ in this. But the timing of the killing of the lamb in Exodus 12 was not the timing of the death of Jesus Christ. So I direct your attention to the Passover book, which shows that the timing of the death of Jesus Christ followed the timing of the sacrifices of the covenant made between God and Abraham in Genesis 15. That follows the timing much more closely. Also, as we come here, we are going to see that this is not a covenant sacrifice. Very important to understand. This is a specific thing that they were to do. Let's come over here to verse 24. Then we'll come back and follow it through. And you shall observe this thing for an ordinance to you and to your sons forever. And forever means until the time that God may decide to change it. Because remember this, whenever God gives a command, only God can change it. Men cannot come along and change it. That's why this becomes a very important thing when we get to the New Covenant Passover, because it becomes different. Okay? This was specifically a sacrifice so that when they put the blood on the side post and the upper lintel, that the destroyer would not come and destroy the firstborn of the children of Israel. That was specifically for that. And so then verse 24 says, you'll observe it forever, and it shall come to pass, verse 25, that when you come into the land which the Lord will give you according as he has promised, that you shall keep this service. And it shall come to pass when your children shall say to you, what do you mean by this service? that you shall say, it is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover. Very important. It's not the Jews' Passover, it's the Lord's Passover. Now today there is a Jews' Passover that is kept on the beginning of the night to be remembered, which is not the Passover. And that's where the confusion comes, and most people don't know why the Jews today don't keep a 14th. Well, we'll explain that in a little bit. Okay. So the meaning is, it's the Lord's Passover who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt, when the and smote the Egyptians and delivered our houses, and the people bowed the head in worship, and the children of Israel went away and did as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. So everything they did was exactly as God had commanded. One of the most important features of it, which is in explaining it by other people, which is this. They were told to stay in their houses until morning, which meant sunrise. Later, the Jews interpreted morning to be after midnight because the destroyer came through, destroyed the firstborn. It was safe to leave the house. Well, if the children of Israel did as Moses commanded, they stayed in their houses until sunrise. Besides, they had to stay there and after the meal, as we will see, they had to burn everything that was left over. Well, let's come back here to verse 5 and let's carry through on this, okay? Exodus 12. Now, verse 6. You shall keep it up until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it between the two evenings. Now, as I have, as you will see in the coming Bible, I have in Exodus 16 a complete study in a footnote showing that between the two evenings means from sunset ba'erev to dark lila, which is night, and the phrase Bain Har Baim applies to that twilight time. So this has to be at the beginning of the 14th and not the end of it. Then they were to take the blood, verse 7, they were to eat it in the house, they were to eat it with unleavened bread. Let's come down here to verse 9, do not eat of it raw, nor boil it all with water, but roast with fire, his head with its legs, so they weren't to cut it, and with the pertinence thereof. Now that means the edible inner organs, the heart, the liver, and the kidneys. You shall leave nothing remained until morning. Now notice he didn't say midnight, because midnight is when the plague came. And that which remains of it until morning, you shall burn with fire. Well, in answering all of these questions, this is why with the Passover book, we wanted to know how long did it take to kill a lamb. We found out it took about 20 minutes to get it all ready. That's about it for a little lamb. We actually had a man in the church at that time who was an expert in slaughtering animals. And I watched him do it. It was very easy to do. Just slit the throat, hang it upside down, let it bleed, cut it down the middle. The whole sack of the innards come out. You just take out the heart, take out the kidney, take out the liver, set that aside. And I was astonished how easy it was to skin it. You just start right along where you cut the belly, and you separate the skin on each side. And then what he did, he put the like a karate chop of the side of the hand. He took both hands and put in where he had cut away from the animal and just took his hands and went whoop right around the back, and it just immediately stripped off all the skin. And we timed it, and it was in 20 minutes the lamb was ready to go. Now, another thing we wanted to find out was this. How long would it take for the bones to burn? See, because they weren't to leave anything of it left. It was to be completely burned. They were, you know how people are superstitious? Remember, Rebecca? What did she want? She wanted to take the little household idol. Okay? She did take it, and she successfully hid it from Laban. But nevertheless, God did not want anyone taking a hoof, you know, a lucky hoof, you know, part of an ear, part of a bone, and then commit idolatry with it. So he had them burn it. So we wanted to know, how long would it take to burn those bones? Well, now, if you have a young lamb that's less than a year old, the bones are not hard, and they burn very quickly. So we wanted to make a test to see how long it would be, so I took a shank bone of a leg of lamb, which would be the biggest and hardest part to burn, and it took 3 hours to completely burn it to ashes. The rest of it would be burned very quickly. Okay? So this means they burned the hide, they burned the bones. I don't know what they did with the guts. Maybe they, I don't know if they burned out or not, but whatever was left from eating, they had to burn. All right. Now, so the sacrifice here of this lamb was a household domestic one, and it was eaten in the house that night. They were to stay in their houses and be ready to go the next morning. Now let's come down here to verse 11. And in this manner you shall eat it, with your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, your staff in your hand. You shall eat it in trepidation. Now that's different in haste. Now, if you eat it in trepidation, that's in fear and trembling. Now in fear and trembling, you may eat it a little quicker than normally. But a lot of those who try and readjust for a 15th Passover say, well, they ate it in haste so they could leave at midnight. Well, you can't change the timing all around because the timing is clear here. Eat it in trepidation. It is the Lord's Passover. So there we have it twice, don't we? The Lord's Passover, because he passed over the houses of the children of Israel. Verse 12, I will pass through the land this night and will smite all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. Now I'm going to bring a sermon which shows that they've had for quite a while, but they haven't really published it, but they've had it since, I think it was about 1908 or 1919, somewhere around there. They have Egyptian records which coincide with all the plagues that took place in Egypt. So I'm going to bring a special sermon on that here not too far down the road. It actually has a picture of where they had this written out. Okay? Now, let's understand something very important. Okay? He's going to judge all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. And the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. And this day, Passover day, which he passed over, shall be for a memorial. This does not refer to the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Because if it did, it would say these days. But it says, this day shall be to you for a memorial. You shall keep it a feast to the Lord throughout your generations, and you shall keep it a feast by an ordinance forever. Now, I've got a sermon coming, and we're also going to have, now concerning the killing of the firstborn, does that mean just the males, or does that include females? Okay. We'll answer that in just a little bit, but it is both. See, and not every firstborn is a male. So what do you do with the female? Okay, we'll answer that right now, since we have our mind on it. Okay, come over here to Exodus 13. Verse 1, Exodus 13. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, sanctify unto me all the firstborn. Whatsoever comes or opens the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and of beast, it is mine. Now, it doesn't say males here, does it? It says all. All would have to include male and female, correct? All right. Now, let's come over here to verse 11. And it shall be, when the Lord shall bring you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore unto you and to your fathers, and to give it to you, and shall give it to you, that you shall set apart unto the Lord all that opens the matrix, every firstling that comes of the beast, and which you have, the males shall be the Lord's. Now let's go on. Every firstling of an ass you shall redeem with a lamb, and if you shall not redeem it, then you shall break his neck, and all the firstborn of man among the children of Israel, or among your children, shall you redeem. What about the females? All right. Let's come to Deuteronomy 14. Now, this will fit in with what we will discuss in Deuteronomy 15 in just a little bit. Let's come to Deuteronomy 14 first, because here is where we need to apply the lesson a little here, a little there, line upon line, precept upon precept, and remember, in understanding the Bible, remember the principle of addition, which is this. The world uses the principle of subtraction. If they don't agree with it, they take it away. Or if there's a conflict with one or the other, they try and eliminate it. Well, what you do, you actually add it together. Okay. Now, Exodus 14 and verse 22. Now, we're going to ask some questions as we go along so that to find out how we can answer this. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your seed that the field brings forth year by year. Put in your notes Numbers 18. Because that's where God gave the tithe to the Levites, and the Levites were to tithe to the priesthood. Okay? God says there, all the tenth of Israel is mine, and I give it to the Levites. Okay? Now, Numbers 27 shows what would happen if you wanted to take of the tithe which belonged to God. What would have to happen? Either the tithe or a special animal. If you wanted to redeem it, what did it cost you? 20%, right? One-fifth thereof. So that tithe which belongs to God was God. You didn't touch it, you didn't eat it, you didn't take it to yourself. Because it was holy to give to the Levites, and the Levites were scattered throughout all of Israel. What would happen? The children of Israel would bring their tithe to the Levites, and the Levites would then send everything up, which was called tenth of a tenth, and also referred to as a heave offering, and that would go to the priesthood, wherever the priesthood was. First it was at Shiloh, and then it was at Geba, and then in Jerusalem. All right, now notice, when we read verse 22 and 23 together here, you shall truly tithe all the increase of your seed that the field brings forth year by year, and you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place which he shall choose to place his name there, the tithe of your corn, of your wine, of your oil, the firstlings of your herds and of your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God. Is God giving permission to them to eat his tithe? Or is this what to do with the tithe for keeping the feasts? Because, notice, they could eat the firstlings of the herds and of the flocks. Now, if it belonged, all the males belonged to God, that went to the Levites and the priesthood. They couldn't eat it. If they ate it, they would be sinning, correct? Yes. So what does this tell us? If we know back there it's talking about the males, this tells us the firstling here has got to be the female, which then is used for the feast. Couldn't be anything other. Otherwise, you would have a total contradiction in God saying, you shall truly tithe, and if you do it, and if you, you know, you take any part thereof, you add a fifth thereof to it, which is 20%. Okay? So what does this mean by figuring this out? Using the principle of addition. Number one, we have the males already described belonging to God, right? That went to the priesthood. Here, they could eat the firstlings of their flock and the herd. So this would have to be, because you can't separate one from the other, this would have to be the females. So all the females were to be used for the offerings and sacrifices that they would eat at the feast. All right, let's continue on. We'll show this here. And if the way be too long for you, so that you're not able to carry it, and if the place be too far for you, which the Lord your God shall choose to set his name there when the Lord your God has blessed you, then you shall turn it into money. Now, you couldn't do that with the first tithe. You would have to add 20% to it. How many here come from a family where the firstborn was female? All right. Happens with animals too, doesn't it? Yes. What do you do with that? Well, here now is a different category because it goes to the feast. Now you can do something with this that you can't do with that which belonged to the Lord, the males, and the tithe to God. See? So, then you shall turn it into money. Well, you read Numbers 27, you don't dare do that. See? And there's no penalty here with saying, and add a fifth part there too. and bind the money in your hand, and you shall go to the place which the Lord your God shall choose, and you shall bestow that money on whatever your soul desires, for oxen, for sheep, for wine, for strong drink, or for whatever your soul desires, and you shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. So that answers the question, what happens to the female? Okay. In other words, it follows right along the same thing, beginning with Adam was created first and then Eve. The males belong to God, the females God expects you to use in holy service to Him. There you go. Follow us now. We will, and this will help answer some questions when we get to Deuteronomy 15, and why the difference between Exodus 12 and Deuteronomy 15. And we will see it is not a change from a domestic Passover to a temple Passover, but something having to do with the firstborn. Now, let's come back to Exodus 12, and let's finish this off here. Okay. So this day should be a memorial, and is not the Passover a memorial? Old covenant with Israel, coming out of Egypt, covenant with Abraham, the promise of the seed, spiritual and physical, but the covenant with Israel, though the Passover lamb was sacrificed for the 14th of the first month, it was not a covenant sacrifice. We'll see that in a little bit. Yeah. The Passover lamb, which was dedicated to God, was a male. Okay? Couldn't use a female for that. That would take away from the typology of Christ. Now, if you want an interesting book, it's The Law of Offerings by Jukes, and that's a tremendous book. I think you can probably still get that at CBD, Christian Book Distributors. The female could be used for the 7 days of unleavened bread. Okay? However, not their first feast of unleavened bread, because all they had was unleavened bread. So if you think you sacrifice and you think that you have a hard time, think about having only unleavened bread to eat for the first 7 days. Okay? So when you read the things in the Old Testament, put yourself into it and think about how difficult this was, and think about how God had to be with them to strengthen them to go on the trip. All right. Now, then it says, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. So you've got a sermon coming which shows that in the New Testament, the 14th day is called the first of the unleavens, meaning the Passover day itself was an unleavened bread day, but not included with the 7 days of unleavened bread. Now, let's read this here. Verse 15. Now, someone told me a very interesting way of remembering this. Verse 14, which of course there weren't verse numbers in the original, but at least in what we have with the English. Verse 14 refers to the 14th day of the month. Verse 15 refers to the 15th day of the month. So I thought that was very clever. And in all the years of being a minister, I never figured that out till she told me. Let's read it. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, even the first day you shall have put away leaven. Be gone before the first day. And I'll tell you another little secret here that is true. There was no leaven available anywhere in Israel for them to eat leavened bread on the day portion of the 14th. Because when you have to unleaven a whole country, now that's a big deal. I mean, to unleaven your home is pretty simple. You just go through your home and unleaven it. Okay. Now, some people have said, well, since it doesn't say you shall not eat leavened bread on the day portion of the 14th, some go out and eat leavened bread on the day portion of the 14th after having had the Passover the night before, and you lose all the symbology of the sinlessness of Christ and his sacrifice, you see. So some have done that. Now, only in today's world, scattered where we are now, are you able, are those kinds of things a possibility. Back then, they had to have everything, their whole country, cleaned out. So I'm sure they were starting like on the 10th, getting, you know, what do you do if you have a bakery? I had one man who had a bakery in Long Beach years and years ago, and he said, what do I do? And I said, well, why don't you clean it all out and become a center for providing unleavened bread? They'd never thought of that. Well, that's what they'd have to do. Okay? But you talk about a big problem. Unleavening a bakery? All right. Now, it shall have put away unleavened bread. For whosoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that same soul shall be cut off from Israel. And in the first day there shall be a holy convocation, and in the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation to you. No manner of work shall be done in it, save that which every man must eat, that only may be done of you. You shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for in the selfsame day I have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day in your generations by an ordinance forever. So we have 2 days, 14th this day, 15th this day. Then he explains it a little further here. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at even. Now, here is where the English translation really makes it difficult. I remember when I had my very first Passover in 1961 in Sacramento, I could not understand evening over here in verse 6 and even over here in verse 18. And it was never explained except to say, well, verse 6 means at the beginning of the day and verse 16 means at the end of the day. Well, how do you know that now? Well, that's why we have the Passover book. Ba'erev is sunset. Sunset ends the day. Now, here is the scripture which ties that together. Let's come to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23. This tells us very clearly, having to do with the Day of Atonement. And this helps unlock the mystery as to why the two evenings are different. The first evening is Bein Harbaim between the two evenings. Then we find in verse 16, even comes from the Hebrew Ba'erev, which means sunset. All right, let's read it here. Verse 32, concerning the Day of Atonement. And it shall be unto you a Sabbath. And Michael pointed this out some months ago when we were down here. Every holy day is called a Sabbath, and every weekly Sabbath is called the Sabbath. Ha Shabbat. And he told me that when he was going to the University of Judaism in L.A., He asked his professor, why do the Pharisees call it, begin counting on the day after the first day of unleavened bread, which is a Sabbath, when Leviticus 23 for the count for Pentecost is the Sabbath? He couldn't answer it except to say, tradition. Let's go to the next track, please.